That's our problem.
The Joint Committee on Tax Reform for Tuesday, June 13, 2017, the morning session will come to order. Colleagues, thank you so much for coming here this morning. We're going to hear first from our Legislative Revenue Officer, Dr. Warner, about the Dash 2 Amendment. And I want you to know the posture of the hearing today. The bill we have in front is essentially a placeholder. What we're considering this morning, what we hope that you'll talk about when it's your turn to testify, will be the Dash 2 Amendment that Dr. Warner is about to explain to us. We have a couple of panels that we have arranged ahead, and when we get through those, we will start the public testimony. We'd ask you to keep your remarks brief and to the point, and if somebody else has already made your comment twice or three times, you might even consider passing and letting the next person talk. Dr. Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. You have a summary from the revenue impact portions of House Bill 2830-2. So the structure the same as the Dash 1, but there are some changes in the policy parameters, and I'll go through those with you. And you can also see our estimated impacts over the next four biennia of each component. The structure remains the same. The minimum remains the same, with a $250 minimum on all entities with receipts of less than $3 million. And then there's a filing threshold of $150,000. So those remain in place. So less than $150,000 in receipts, there's no filing required. For those with receipts above $3 million, there's now an additional rate category. The 0.75 for services, as you saw before, 0.35% for retail trade, 0.25 for wholesale, and we've added a category, 0.15, for agriculture, forestry, and fishing. So that's a new component relative to the Dash 1. And then the catch-all category, and this would include construction, manufacturing, is 0.48%. Now, one of the major changes in the Dash 2 is the fact that the commercial activity tax is not implemented until 1/1/19. That's one of the biggest changes compared to the Dash 1, which had a 1/1/18 start date. So this would go into effect 1/1/19. There would be a 50% credit for pass-throughs in 2019, the first year of implementation. And then that would drop to 25% in 2020. So remember that this is a credit that is taken at the entity level. So you would fill out your estimate what your CAT liability is, and if you're a pass-through entity, then you would take the credit, and then that you would net that out of your CAT liability at the entity level. The personal income rate structure has an additional bracket in it, again a change from the Dash 1s. The 4.5% and 6.5% are the same. There's an 8.75% rate, which you saw in the Dash 1, but now this bracket is truncated at 25,000 single, 50,000 joint. So you would have, as you go through the brackets from 16,000 to 50,000 for a joint filer, you'd have a marginal rate of 8.75%. And then at that point, it would revert back to the current 9%. So you're creating a fifth bracket there in the middle, and then lowering the bottom two brackets. And then the 9 and 9.9 would stay in place. The 9, of course, would apply to less income than it does currently, and the 9.9 would have the same threshold as it does now. Another major change in the Dash 2 is that there's a temporary corporate income tax rate increase that would be effective with the current corporate tax year. Remember, those corporate tax years are staggered. So it would be effective 1/1/17, and it would be, it's right currently at 6.6% for the first million in net corporate income. That would be moved to 8%, and currently it's 7.6% for net corporate income above a million. That would go to 9%. So that would be the change from 6.6 to 8 and 7.6 to 9. Then, as in the Dash 1, when the CAT goes into effect, then the corporate income tax is eliminated. So that would be removed. And, of course, a lot of the language, in the, just as in the Dash 1, but a lot of the language you see in the amendment is repealing those, basically a full chapter of statute. And also what remains the same as the Dash 1 is the repeal of the pass-through rate a 1117. That's in a list of statutes that are repealed at the end. That's where that appears. So now if you look at the revenue on impact of this of the dash two, the commercial activity tax goes into effect for the last 6 months of the biennium. So we're estimating you'll get about $539 million in gross revenue. The 50% CAT credit would apply. The pass-through entities are about 25% of the total revenue. So that calculation is 25% times the 50% credit for that $67 million in credit. Personal income tax would take effect with a 1119 because it's a rate change. We assume it would affect withholding, and that's the estimate for a partial year for the 19 calendar year. The special rate would go into would be repealed with 2017 for pass-throughs, and that would be in effect really more than 2 years, and that's why you have the slight drop-off next biennium. Corporate income tax rate increase from 8 to 9% would generate about $204 million is our estimate for the 17-19 biennium. Net all that together, the estimate is an $890 million increase in revenue for the 17-19 biennium. So, and then when you look at 1921, the CAT is in effect for a full biennium. The credit has the CAT pass-through credit is 50% for the last second half of calendar year 19, and then it reverts to 25%. And you can see the estimate there. The personal income tax rate reductions are in effect for the full biennium, so a minus 353 pass-through, and the corporate income repeal goes into effect, so you lose basically the current law estimate for corporate income taxes, a lower $1 billion is currently projected. So the net for 1921 is $1.165 billion. So that's the dash two. We continue to work on some of the mechanics around it. One thing we are spending time on and already beginning to work on a dash three is how you would treat closely related entities within the CAT and how that would be calculated. And also we've looked at how you determine who's eligible for what rates, the definitions of the industries and how that's worded. So those are a couple of things that we're working on. We'll continue to work, and then as we come up with those changes, then we'll come back to you with a dash three.
Thank you. We'll have time for a couple of questions now, but we can, of course, talk to Paul any time. Senator Hass?
Thank you. Just to be clear, Ben, this two-year bridge, there's only two changes that we're making, the repeal of the pass-through special rate and the bump in the corporate income tax, and that's the only thing for this bridge, but you get the extra $500 in revenue because it's the first 6 months of the next biennium.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, that's true. Both those changes, the corporate rate and the change in the pass-through rate, would be effective for the current tax year for 2017.
Thank you.
One other thing, Mr. Co-Chair, we did put on OLIS a simulation based on the dash two, so that's you can look at that at your pleasure, and we'll answer any questions on that if you have.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Filkin. Appreciate your coming this morning. If you'd state your name for the record and then give your testimony, we'd appreciate that.
Certainly. Good morning to everyone. And I, for the record, my name is Tim Filkins. I'm a member and past chair of the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants. I am a certified public accountant in public practice with the firm of Timothy R. Filkins, CPA LLC, located in Portland. First of all, we appreciate your joint efforts to navigate various strategies as you seek solution to the state's projected budget deficit. And we recognize that you'll be deciding on some very difficult decisions. The following comments are based on our experiences of working with our business clients and our perspective on how tax rates affect businesses. We're providing input that we hope will be considered and perhaps useful in the committee's decision making. We recognize and understand that whatever the final legislation outcome is The results will be brought about by having to make tough choices on ways to raise additional revenues. On behalf of the OSCPA, I would like to briefly and respectfully advance a few considerations related to the Dash 2 amendment of the House bill. First, with regard to tax adjustment considerations, an adjustment to the corporate income tax rate is the least intrusive method of adjusting taxes, as businesses will be able to plan for these changes. With regard to the commercial activity tax, we applaud the committee for considering the various industry types and determining what the rate of gross receipts tax should be. If you decide upon a gross receipts tax, it appears the system is somewhat similar to the state of Washington business and occupation tax, B&O tax, which makes sense because it takes into account the differences in the industry that businesses operate and the rate of tax. Other considerations related to the gross receipts tax. It is possible that the gross receipts tax could have a negative impact on the other functions of business, in that a gross receipts tax could cause a company to devote more time and resources in monitoring cash flow, inventory levels, and employee counts as compared to monitoring profits. The Oregon pass-through activities tax rate, although we understand the Oregon PTE provision is being considered for repeal, we would ask the committee to consider an amendment to the current statute for the prior years. The amendment that we suggest would allow eligible Oregon pass-through taxpayers to file amended returns to correct their prior year tax returns if the lower tax rate was omitted in their originally filed returns. Thank you for this opportunity to share perspective at today's hearing.
Thank you very much. Any brief questions? Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony. David Bernier, Carol Christ, and Matt Ellis, please. Gentlemen, thank you. Who am I missing?
Carol.
Oh, there she is. Thank you. Please go ahead. If you'd state your name for the record and then give your testimony, we would appreciate that.
My name is Carol Christ, and I'm a member of the Main Street Alliance. My husband and I live just outside of Dallas, and we have owned a small pizza restaurant since 2006 in Dallas. He's at the restaurant today, like every day. But I could come here because we both value our public schools. We both attended public school, and our sons did, and now our grandchildren do. We are concerned about that, because some corporations pay far too little in taxes in Oregon. We must not consider any further cuts to public schools. This keeps eroding the right to a free and appropriate education, which is crucial to sustaining our nation. We hope that you will be able to put our state's young people first, because that puts our freedoms and our future first. Here's what Thomas Jefferson said about people needing education. Educate and inform the whole mass of the people. Enable them to see that it is their interest to preserve peace and order, and they will preserve them. They are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. Jefferson also wrote, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free, it expects what never was and never will be. I don't know if he planned to rhyme that, but it does. The bill that you are considering is a positive development, and I hope that the legislature will pass a tax increase that can make a real difference. For children in our Dallas school district, inadequate funding will be devastating. It will mean that we cannot return to the days when kindergartners could actually have a short conversation with their teacher. One of our granddaughters just finished kindergarten in a class of 28. Have you spent any time in a classroom with 28 lively 5- and 6-year-olds? Whew, I have, and it's hard to concentrate. Young kids learn by interacting with materials and interacting with people. They're moving, they're talking, because they're thinking. The school staff all work hard, but Oregonians and other states too, we keep expecting educators to do more with less. That is like we require them to do their best, and then we make it impossible. Big classes are just one example, so if you check with other school districts, you can find out the specific cuts that they have made. Schools are just not the same since we were in school ourselves. So we need a significant revenue package. We have to reverse decades of disinvestment in our schools and other crucial services. I urge you to not just raise new revenue, but to raise sufficient revenue that will make a significant difference. Sometimes we say it's time to change the game, but for our children, this is no game. The students who are in school now and the little ones who start in the fall are counting on you to lead. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen.
Hello, I'm Dave Vernier, co-founder and co-president of Vernier Software and Technology. We make stuff for science teachers, sensors, and write software, and write books for science teachers in K-12 and through and college. We have about 115 employees, and we're in Beaverton, Oregon. As a business owner, I believe my part of my role is to support the community. I donate to local charities. I support the employees who give. I volunteer for nonprofits, and I try to run our business in accordance with the values that I believe most Oregonians share. I believe our corporate success has come from our support of the community, and it makes us a better company. We direct a lot of our philanthropy and volunteer efforts toward education, and we know that a lot of other businesses work on these philanthropic and volunteer efforts to support education. But corporate philanthropy is not enough to fix the problems we have. Our underfunded public schools, colleges, and universities. For corporations in Oregon to address the problems, we must be willing to pay more taxes. That is why I support Speaker Kotex and Senator Haas's reform, Revenue Reform and Education Stability Act, which would rebalance our tax system and generate much-needed funding for schools and services. I've been in Oregon long enough to see how things have changed. Corporations in Oregon used to pay a significant portion of income taxes in the state, and over the years, the revenue from corporations has dropped drastically. Frankly, corporations are just not paying their fair share any longer. Oregon's K-12 public schools need more financial support. I can see it in statistics, third largest class sizes in the country, one of the shortest school years, and low high school graduation rates. Also, skyrocketing college tuition costs. Oregon's education woes are not new, but they are fixable. Speaker Kotek and Senator Haas's plan is the beginning of a new investment, and it's one I strongly support. I'll just add a comment. Our company pays corporate activity taxes in several states. I know Ohio and Washington. I think there's 3 or 4 others. So this is not a new thing. We all know that our low school funding is partly driven by Oregon's low corporate taxes, because Oregon business owners pay fewer taxes than in other states. Our schools and universities receive fewer resources than they need. This revenue plan is what Oregonians have been waiting for, and I say this as a business owner who would pay this tax. Our state will be able to make meaningful investments in job skill training and hire thousands of teachers and reduce class size sizes and increase college affordability, among other major strides. I'll add another note. I think it's really critical to keep public education at a level where people consider it good enough for my kids. Of the 115 employees at our company, most of them have young children. I'm sure more than half. And I think almost every single one of them sends their kids to public schools. I think it is wonderful that they perceive public education right now as good enough for my kids. It's a slippery slope if we aren't careful and we underfund schools much longer. You're going to see the slippery slope of the good teachers leaving for other places, the best, wealthiest parents pulling out their kids, and some of those are going to be some of the best kids. It is a slippery slope toward a time when you see the schools as not good enough for my kids. Think of the financial impact on our middle-class employees to think that they have to pay thousands or tens of thousands of dollars a year to send their kids to a private school. Investing in education and critical services is the right thing to do because our businesses are only as successful as the communities we serve. Our economy is only as strong as its citizens can make it. Without new investments in schools and higher education, we will always underachieve. With businesses doing their part, we can excel, and that's the Oregon I believe we deserve. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Good morning to the committee. Thank you, Co-Chair Senator Haas and Representative Barnhart, for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Matt Ellis, and I'm the founder and CEO of a company called Cloudability. I'll tell you just a bit about what we do, since the name may not be familiar. Cloud technology is where companies rent computer systems instead of buying them. If you've watched a movie on Netflix or taken a ride on Uber, you've used the cloud, and Cloudability supports companies like those to make their cloud more efficient and powerful. The point of my telling you about what my company does is to convey just how common it is that companies like mine are needed for everyday business in our society. I know that technology can sometimes seem amorphous and maybe a bit off-putting, but there's a good chance that you rely on a technology similar to ours in your own lives. Given the ever-increasing use of technology in our society for everything from education to farming, companies like mine are going to continue to grow in this state. We started with 3 employees 6 years ago, and now we employ nearly 100 in Portland with a median salary of over $100,000. These companies make very significant contributions to the Oregon economy, and our perspective on corporate taxes should be taken seriously. I'm here today actually advocating on behalf of my employees. I'm competing with companies like Google and cities all over the world to retain my highly skilled workforce. A big factor in our favor is the perceived quality of life here in Oregon. Yet when they have children, they encounter an underfunded school system combined with a reluctance to consider anything beyond spending cuts to solve the myriad problems. It's not as if I don't pay them enough so they couldn't send their kids to private school, but they do not want to send their kids to private schools. They want to live in a community which adequately invests in education and other critical services. And that's not what's been happening. Just this year, I've lost staff to places like London, Austin, Berlin, and Helsinki, drawn by a higher quality of life, in part because of the education. We're located in the Pearl District in Portland and have been a member of the Portland Business Alliance for 3 years. Earlier this year, we seized the opportunity to also become founding members of Business for a Better Portland because we believe that businesses should do more than just advocate through its associations. We absolutely must also advocate for the community which is supporting our staff and their families. It is unconscionable to me that some business organizations want to prevent you from even considering revenue reform. Let me be clear, I was opposed to Measure 97. It was the wrong approach to a corporate activities tax. This time, you've taken the time to hear from businesses and address our concerns. You've modified the rate structure to address the different types of businesses, and it will be phased in over several years to give the state time to figure out important implementation details. If you want to foster a vibrant tech industry in this state and the well-paid jobs that come with it, you'll have to make the necessary investments, which starts with an appropriately funded education system. And it sounds to me like you've done exactly what your opponents have asked you to do. I encourage you and your fellow legislators to pass this measure in this session and not impose on Oregonians another divisive, costly ballot measure. We have great plans this year at our company to grow not only our business, but also our corporate philanthropy programs in partnership with Business for a Better Portland. I would much rather allocate our time and energy to helping homeless folks at Christmas than have to squirrel that money away for a needless ballot campaign measure that could have been avoided by asserting your leadership here in the Senate Capitol. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair. Thank you all for being here. Mr. Vanier, I have a question for you. You mentioned that you pay a corporate gross receipts tax in a couple of other states. I realize you probably have staff or CPAs who handle that, but do you have any sense of the complexity of that process?
I'm not really involved in that part of the business, but I talked to my wife this morning, and she reminded me that Ohio, I think any company that sells over $1 million, anything, and I think it's pretty easy. I think that we've done more, had more hassles paying sales tax in many, many states, which is the common thing now. So we literally spend, our tax returns are this tall. Mm-hmm. But most of that sales tax is in various states.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bershiger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hear your concerns over school funding, and we just passed a very significant school funding bill, $8.2 billion. So when you look at the numbers in Oregon between the money the state puts into the schools and property tax, it's in excess of $13,000 per student. If you add in capital construction, that pushes it past $15,000 per student. What number do you think would be adequate per student for our education system?
If you're familiar with the budget enough to answer that question.
Senator Bershiger, I'm not familiar with the numbers. My staff are looking for a state that supports a growing education system and not one that's trying to reduce that number. They look for one that's trying to increase that number. You could send any amount of money and waste it, but like a growing number means more importance on education. And when you're looking at having a child, you're looking for a 10, 12 year period where you want to know it's going to get better, not worse.
Follow up?
Briefly, yes.
I guess what I'm saying is that is a growing number. We keep growing it. We're at an excess of $13,000 per student. I mean, does that need to be $20,000 per student? Is that adequate funding for education, or is it $17,000?
I understand it's been lower over the last 25 years.
Yes.
No.
Thank you, Senator.
No.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen, and Ms. Christ. We appreciate your testimony. Dana Hepper, Mark Jackson, and Lamar Wise, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thanks so much for the opportunity to speak this morning. My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Director of Policy and Program at the Children's Institute. And our goal is to ensure that all children have the opportunity to reach their full potential. I can't speak to the details of how you should structure corporate taxes or what budget reforms you should make this session, but what I can speak to is the needed investments in early childhood and young children and their families. Early brain development sets the foundation for later learning in school and in life. Early literacy and math skills, of course, support school success, but even more important is that social-emotional development that happens in young children. Kids Count released their report yesterday and found that Oregon was really lagging in our education outcomes. And of course, this begins with our youngest children. Babies are learning starting at birth, and achievement gaps can be identified, or opportunity gaps, as early as 9 months of age. We know also that more and more families are working, and that high-quality early childhood opportunities are not just a luxury, they're a necessity for many families who need high-quality care for their children as they are at work. But here's the good news. We know exactly what to do in order to get better outcomes for our children. There's been an Early Childhood and Family Support Committee all this session in the House, and they've heard a number of powerful stories, one on home visiting. We heard from a young woman who, after experiencing years of abuse and neglect as a child herself, found herself a mother at 15 years old. She testified she didn't know if she was capable of loving her child. But after working with a home visitor, she is now the mom of a thriving teenager who's on track to graduate from high school. She graduated from high school and college herself, and now she's a home visitor with the Healthy Families Oregon program. This is an amazing success, but we're only serving 20% of the families who we know could use this service. In preschool, we see the same situation. We heard from a mom, Sadia. She raised her first 6 children in a Somali refugee camp. Her 7th children was born here in America, and he's now enrolled in a preschool promise program with 19 other Somali children who are meeting their needs and the needs of their families. She feels confident that he's going to thrive in school in a way that her older children are not. But we have 25,000 low-income children in Oregon who are not enrolled in preschool. The unmet need is substantial across multiple early childhood investments, early intervention, early childhood special ed, serves kids with disabilities, and yet only 30% of 0 to 3-year-olds who have an identified disability or delay are getting the service level that we know they need to meet their full potential. Head Start teachers often qualify for Head Start services because the pay is so low. The early childhood workforce across the board needs substantial investment so that educators who play a critical role in the development of young children get the ongoing education and professional development they need. Our current state investment is next to zero. Despite the huge unmet need, the current budget, with no revenue and no cost savings measures passed, proposes cuts to many of these programs, a 10% cut to Preschool Promise, a 10% cut to Healthy Families Oregon, a 20% cut to Early Learning Hubs and the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund, and a $20 million cut to child care subsidy for low-income families. We not only need to get to CSL, we need to do a lot better than CSL. The early childhood community who follows this work and very closely and understands the ins and outs, details of that side, if we can't tell you about this stuff. We've identified $150 million in needed investments that we're ready to implement in a high-quality way this biennium. So we really appreciate this committee for acting with urgency, for keeping your eye on adequacy, and for your work to figure out the complicated details of how to structure taxes and budget reforms in this state. So thank you for that work, and we hope that after you do that, we're going to make sure early childhood is on the priority list for receiving some of these dollars.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen.
Good morning, co-chairs Hassan Barhart. My name is Lamar Wise. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. I'm here today to tell you that students are drowning in debt and that the status quo in funding our higher education system is simply inadequate. On average, Oregon students graduate with $31,000 in debt. I personally left the University of Oregon with over $38,000 in debt. Without dedicating more revenue to education, we're telling middle and low-income families that their chances at opportunity doesn't matter. You're telling that the over 50,000 students that we've registered and educated over the state, that the state can't deliver the basic resources to fund their education. And you're telling students that go to bed hungry or who are homeless that they are on their own. I was one of those students. My sophomore year, I couch surfed for 6 months. I wasn't able to afford rent because of the high tuition at the U of O. I remember my bank account at in the red, and I distinctly remember the rumblings of my stomach before going to bed at night because of the hunger. And yeah, you can say that I was determined, and I was. I was determined to get here today to tell you all that this is not okay, that this is inaccessible, and that we can do better as a state. And I'm also here to tell you that current service level isn't enough. The proposal that you all are discussing today is a move in the right direction, but it is still not enough for the students who go to bed hungry and who are still struggling every day to be able to provide opportunity for their families. Our legacy as a state is on the line, and your all's legacy is on the line when we talk about the resources that is necessary to continue to hold this state and our education system at a level where students can actually succeed and thrive. But at this point, we're barely making it by. And that's a choice that we have to make, right? It's a choice that we have an opportunity to address through this tax reform and through the proposals that you all are discussing. With that being said, students have protested at just about every university campus. Students have also flooded the Higher Education Coordinating Commission's tuition setting meeting, which happened at the beginning of May. And there was a lot that went on at that meeting. But what was clear is that students from around the state are struggling and have stories upon stories to tell about their struggles and about why the state needs to continue to fund higher education. And at every step of the way, we've heard that our hands are tied and we're waiting for the legislature to fix our broken system. And so I'm here today to ask you all to fix it because there are hundreds of thousands of students needing this reform and needing it now. And the proposal that you have in front of you is a path forward. I respectfully urge this committee to support the Revenue Reform and Education Stability Act and also to consider raising more revenue to make sure that we get to current subverse level. I believe that we're almost there, and I believe that this is the right direction for us, but we need to continue to work hard to find an adequate resource for our students so that they have an opportunity to be successful in the next biennium. Thank you all so much for the opportunity to speak, I'll pass it off to the gentleman on my right.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Good morning, co-chairs Barnhart and Haas, members of the committee. My name is Mark Jackson, co-founder and executive director of REAP Incorporated. We're a multicultural youth reach organization based in Portland, Oregon. Today I'm here to lend my support of House Bill 2018, commonly known as the Revenue Reform and Education Stability Act of 2017. As I reflect on the possibilities of House Bill 2830, I'm reminded of the realities of our current landscape of our public school system. Oregon ranks third worst in graduation rates in the nation. We are failing our students of color at an even greater rate on this measure. We have a short school year. We have large classroom sizes, and the high school to student council ratio is dismal. To better serve our students, we need to provide our students with the time and support they need to graduate. This means hiring more teachers of color and training all staff in the use of culturally responsive practices. It also means investing in community-based organizations that offer essential supports that contribute to our students' success toward college and career readiness. According to research by Echo Northwest, if the achievement gap of Oregon's adult population had been eliminated a decade ago, Oregon's economic activity would have been $1.9 billion higher than 2013. Male students in 2014-15, as in prior years, dropped out at a higher rate than female students, with the exception of multiracial students. Male students of every ethnicity dropped out at a higher rate than female students of the same ethnicity. American Indian, Alaska Native, and Black male students have the highest dropout rate in our state. Oregon can and should do better for our children. Not only are we turning our backs on this generation of young people and well-intended educators, we are putting our state's future at risk. Adults without diplomas earn less and are more likely to be involved in the juvenile justice system and are less engaged in the community. As elected officials, you have the opportunity to create a renaissance in our public school system that will change the narrative of the future of our state. It's time to send a clear, courageous, and collective message to our students that they are the best investment in town. It is a bold leadership that REAP employs in our schools we serve across the Portland metro area. We are a current grantee of House Bill 2016. We also are a current grantee of the Oregon Youth Development Council. And those investments have produced some real promising, compelling results. We have seen an increase in students of color on track graduation. We're seeing an increase in the graduation rates for high school students of color. We've also seen a reduction in the number of discipline incidents and suspensions that have historically led many of our students of color into the pipeline from school to prison. For example, the following school partners experienced a reduction in discipline incidents with REAP support in this current school year. Oliver, K-6 in the Statillion School District. Last year they had 609 discipline referrals. This year it's down to 486. Park Lane, K-6 school. Last year had 1,074 referrals around discipline, down to 334. Centennial High School, last year 571, down to 364. Aloha High School, last year was 1,288, down to 700. With our supports and our community partnerships in these schools, we're seeing that the pipeline from school to prison is being dismantled and destroyed. It is my request and recommendation that as a committee, you support House Bill 2830. The Revenue Reform and Education Stability Act dedicates hundreds of millions of dollars to our schools, fulfilling the promises we made to the next generation. By investing in schools, we can finally give Oregon kids the education they deserve. This funding could also add back days to the school year, reduce class sizes, and allow districts to restore educational programs, including vocational and technical training, that have been cut since the last recession. The proposal calls for funding efforts to improve Oregon's graduation rate. I may add also it's important you all continue to support investments in the idea of equity. Very, very important, specifically House Bill 2016. I want to conclude by sharing a personal story with one of the students in our program named Ishwag, who was a senior at Madison High School in the Portland area at the beginning of the school year, had a history of behavior problems, in-class outbursts, low attendance, and a GPA below 1.0. He enrolled in the REAP program at the start of the school year and is now a graduating senior with a GPA of 3.0. These types of narratives and stories are just an example of what can happen if we make wise investments. The inadequate, unstable status quo in educational funding has had a disproportionate impact on kids of color and low-income students. If legislators seize this opportunity and make meaningful, sustained, and strategic investments in education, we could create life-changing opportunities for students, families, community, and the whole state and economy. Imagine how many more students can experience the same level of success as Ishwag did. Support House Bill 2830. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Johnson, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Lamar, when President Ray from OSU was testifying in front of the Ed Subcommittee, I think last month, he mentioned that one of the significant reasons for the tuition increases was the cost drivers that other public employers in Oregon are experiencing. So I guess my question to you and the students is, in addition to new revenues, would you also support serious legislative action on structural budget reforms that could help reduce some of those cost drivers that are responsible for tuition increases, so we could direct more state school funding, or pardon me, more state funding into student services?
So we believe that with the revenue package also should be a serious conversation about cost containment, and that's something that we have been supportive of.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very much appreciate your testimony this morning. Ashley Henry, Judah McCauley, John Calhoun, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is John Calhoun and I'm a resident of Portland. As several of you know, I retired last year after a 45-year career in business. I spent close to 20 years in financial management at Intel, 25 years as an entrepreneur, CFO, and investor. Based upon that experience, I'm speaking in support of HB 2830 in order to reform our corporate tax structure. I will not spend time discussing the need for the funds, as we all know our schools' critical services are in dire need, and many others will discuss that today. Instead, I want to say I think this is a well-crafted proposal. We all know that the corporate income tax has been decreasing as a share of our total revenue, with the result that we now have the lowest business taxes in the country, and that individuals must bear the burden of financing the state.
Mr. Calhoun, we do have your written testimony, and members can read it. If you can summarize the high points, that would be extremely appreciated.
I'd like to. As long as a tax is based upon income, large corporations will continue to find ways to avoid paying taxes. While I was at Intel, I helped justify shifting profits to our Asian tax haven. I know how it's done. The corporate activities tax will solve that problem. In no company I was involved, from manufacturing to software to services, did we ever make a pricing decision based on state or local taxes. The operating divisions are almost always measured on a pre-tax basis. That means that corporations that produce products and sell them across the country are not going to adjust their prices because we provide a different tax structure. I realize that certain businesses like grocery stores could, because they have such a small profit margin. However, your plan provides such a low percentage tax on their sales that it will provide, creates a very small increase in their tax burden and their costs, so very little, if anything, will be passed on. I'm also pleased the fact that you start the tax rate at $3 million. Most small startups that are the innovative companies that we're trying to generate in this state don't have sales above that figure in this state. The business that I sold last year had 65 employees, $8 million in revenue, but only $500,000 in the state. Our tax burden would go down based on this formula. That's the way to help smaller innovative companies compete with their larger firms that have avoided paying their fair share of taxes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Representative Barnhart, Senator Haas and committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Ashley Henry. I am the Chief Collaboration Officer for an organization called Businesses for a Better Portland. You just heard earlier from one of our members, Matt Ellis, who's the CEO of Cloudability. I won't read our letter to you now. We will submit that to the record later this afternoon. That will include endorsements from about 25 additional companies supporting today's the plan that you're considering today. I think the thing that I would like to convey to you here in the committee is really more specifically around the opportunity that you have provided throughout this process for businesses to provide input, which we really appreciate. All the time that our member companies have had the opportunity to have conversations with many of you about the tax structure and the, quite frankly, addressing a lot of the concerns that many of our members had about Measure 97, and that you have been very skillful at addressing those concerns. And we're quite frankly a little worried that if you're not successful in passing this, what would actually happen is a much more simplified version that we would see on the ballot, and that we would be caught in yet another divisive ballot measure. So I really want to encourage courage and leadership. We are at a historic moment right now, and we do have an opportunity to finally address some of these structural challenges, not only on the revenue side, but on the cost containment side as well. And we so appreciate all the efforts that you've made thus far. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you. My name's Judah McCauley, and I'm here representing myself. I'm also a member of Business for Better Portland. I'm director of engineering for a software company in Portland, Oregon called Treetop Commons. We provide a data platform for tracking public service, volunteer efforts, and community engagement. I came here today, and once again, let me start out just by saying thank you, Co-Chair Barnhart and Senator Haas, and all the members of the committee. This is my first time coming down and testifying in the legislature, and there's good reason for that, and that's because I think this is an incredibly important time for our whole state and for investment in education. Little background, I'm the fifth generation, born and raised in Willamette Valley. I've got a daughter heading into fifth grade next year at Sablin Elementary. She's the sixth. I've started four businesses in the state, and I'm now director of engineering for a software company that's dedicated to growing our company here in Portland. And so what I'm trying to say by that is I'm here for the long haul. Like, I'm an Oregonian, not going anywhere, but I've seen the state change. I grew up going to school in the 80s and 90s here in Oregon, and it was a different model. You know, when I was in my daughter's grade, I got to go out and have enrichment education through TAG. I had to go to a special program, get additional education opportunities that were specifically designed for engaging me, making sure I didn't get too bored with school, and that my curiosity was nourished. My daughter doesn't have those. It's just not an option. They try to fold in what they can in school, but she doesn't have anything like the education opportunities that I did even, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And I've seen it change. You know, I've seen our revenue tax structure change. I've seen the disinvestment in education during my entire lifetime. You know, I went through the U of O, and you know, it's a scary thing raising a kid right now in Oregon. It makes me really kind of worry about the future of our state and, you know, what we're going to be giving to her as she heads off to middle school and then high school and then hopefully college again here in Oregon. And as an employer, you know, as a director of engineering, I hire software developers predominantly. I hire well-educated people, and I pay them really well, and, you know, I invest in the local economy. But in order to hire these people, which is incredibly difficult, I need a well-educated workforce. I need people that are engaged. I need, for hiring people from afar, I need a place. A lot of these people are 20 and 30-year-old folks with young kids. They're coming here. They need to see, and not only the wonderful, you know, gorgeous environment that's, you know, on all the pictures, they need to see infrastructure that sustains our communities. They need to see education that sustains our communities. They need to come here and see that this is a place that they can grow and live for the long term, just like I have. So I'm here today to talk about this bill and the amendment that's in front of us, because I believe that this is our last best hope at compromise. And I've been very impressed with what the committee has done thus far, coming back and forth and listening to business interests such as mine. I don't know everything about tax reform, you know, but I'm a business owner, and I do know a thing or two about budgets. And I know that it's hard, and that the time to make the hardest decisions is when times are best. Right now, we're at the hopefully not the tail end of the longest expansion that I've seen in my lifetime. But certainly, you know, there are storm clouds potentially ahead. And yet we're still facing a budget deficit and disinvestment in education that doesn't come up to meet the quality education model that this legislature passed. If we're going to make change, we have to make structural reform changes. And in my opinion, it has to be done now. So while I've seen blunt instruments such as Measure 97, I believe that the approach that's being pushed forward by this committee right now represents a great compromise that I, as a small business person, can really get behind. And quite frankly, there's nothing in this but upside for me. My company doesn't yet do $3 million a year in sales in Oregon. We sell all over the country and hopefully soon internationally. Selling $3 million just in the state of Oregon is a problem I would love to have. You know, and if that helps, if we get to that point and that helps companies like mine grow and get to that point, and we have the sustained investment, the levels we know we need to have in Oregon, then I think that we're going to be fantastically successful. There will be no barriers placed in our way to growing and becoming successful. So I'm here today to urge you and thank you for your leadership thus far and ask you to continue it by passing this amendment and the underlying bill and investing in Oregon.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you all. Very much appreciate your testimony. Jenny Dressler, Anthony Smith, Thomas Hammer, please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to attend today and testify in response to the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2830. My name is Jenny Dressler, and I am the Director of State Public Policy for the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Oregon Farm Bureau represents 7,000 farm and ranch families actively engaged in production agriculture and 65,000 members statewide. Our members represent farms of all sizes across the state and of all organizational structures. As the second largest traded sector industry in Oregon, we appreciate the acknowledgement in the Dash 2 amendments that the ag industry faces unique challenges. Farmers and ranchers are not only exposed to unpredictability in the marketplace, but they are also price takers and often operate on extremely thin margins. 2016 was particularly tough for many farm families, given the low price of commodities in the global market. And many of the families that I spoke to told me that they were operating in the red in 2016. And so it's with this lens that we provide our comments and feedback on the Dash 2 amendments today. For some background on Farm Bureau, Oregon Farm Bureau is guided by our grassroots and our policy development process that occurs annually. Our members, through this process, have made it clear that they are opposed to any tax mechanism that separates the obligation to pay from the ability to pay. Our policy states that we're opposed to any tax based on gross income and that nobody should be required to pay an income-related tax when there is no net income. So while the proposed 0.15% commercial activities tax for agriculture is a recognition that we appreciate of the challenges faced by our industry, the proposed cap would still tax a farm sales whether a farmer makes profit or not that year. Additionally, we are concerned about the effects of pyramiding on family farmers and ranchers. And we put together a little diagram that you all have in front of you. It takes energy and inputs to produce food and fiber. And the more volume that you produce, the more energy and inputs are actually required to do so. I think that that's why farmers are uniquely impacted by the effects of pyramiding in the proposal. We actually use the retail rate of 0.11% that was in the joint SIM 12, and then I just looked at the new simulation. I think it's 0.15% as the potential price increase. So my model's a little, or my diagram's a little old, but just wanted to flag that for you all. I guess turning away from the CAT proposal for a moment and looking at the package in its entirety, we wanted to highlight a couple of impacts that we see to pass-through entities. Many farm families are organized this way, although not all farm families, and they would be taxed first on their sales if they have sales over $3 million, and then second on their profits. Eliminating the small business tax cut would also result in a tax increase for many of our member families organized as S-Corps or partnerships. And our concern with the proposal in front of us is that applying that elimination to the 2017 tax year actually impacts those families, and it would be tough for those families who have made business decisions based on the assumption that they would fall under that tax rate. So in 2017, I think families would be particularly hit by their business decisions. While the 50% CAT tax credit will lessen some of that impact for those that have sales over $3 million or more, our internal modeling still shows a tax increase for those pass-through entities that have taken the small business tax cut. But as you can imagine, our membership not only represents a large diversity of commodities produced, but also a diversity of business structures. And depending on how that farm is organized, the proposed tax package could result in an increase or a decrease in their farm's tax burden. And surveys of our members have shown that to be true as well. So while we don't speak for the individual farms that may see a different impact under this proposal, we are here today to provide feedback on behalf of the industry as a whole and with regard to the heartburn that we have with the gross receipts tax mechanism. To close, we appreciate the recognition of the challenges and distinct features of agricultural production as you've crafted this package, and we commit to continue to engage in a positive way to find the right balance between the needs of both the private and the public sector. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Questions for...
Let's go ahead through the panel, and then we'll take questions for everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Hammer. Co-chairs Haas and Barnhart. I'm Tom Hammer of Salem. I've owned small businesses in manufacturing and retail that were C corporations first, then S corporations, and finally LLCs. Currently, our family owns commercial real estate as an LLC. I farm as a sole proprietor. My son owns an auto repair business as an LLC. Your commercial activity tax would hurt small businesses of all kinds. Years ago, I watched sales tax plan number 7 go down to defeat, just as the 6 before it. I saw 97 get voted down as well. Oregonians don't want a sales tax. This new scheme is just another sales tax with a new look, and not so courageously done away from the ballot box this time. This would be the third leg on the stool, a foot on the first rung, a third leg on the tax stool, where taxpayers could easily be abused in perpetuity. We don't have a real shortfall. It's just contrived, for the most part, to get a sales tax. With right to work likely in this presidential term, SEIU, OEA, they need this to retain their power in the future as they prepare to lose a half of their dues-paying income. When the public sector takes money out of the private sector faster than wealth is created, private citizens lose economic freedom. That's what this cat will do, and that's why I'm opposed to it. It rewards out-of-control public spending and adds dues-paying members to the PERS pyramid scheme. It does this by penalizing healthy small businesses that are a major employer in Oregon. The cat will cause low-margin businesses to lose sales as their customers shop across state lines. It will discourage businesses from locating here. Employers will find it more difficult to add employees or even retain existing levels. I know you've heard these arguments before, but they're continually ignored. Oregonians per capita are taxed far more than those in neighboring states. As I understand the numbers, it's $8,600 per taxpayer in Oregon, about $5,000 in Washington and California. Right now, Oregon taxpayers, they serve state government. State government doesn't serve taxpayers. State government serves public union bosses and the environmental extremists. The extremists have succeeded in diminishing our resource-based industries. We've heard,
Mr. Hammer, could you stick your confine your remarks to the matter that's in front of us, please?
Yes, sir.
Comments are not germane here this morning.
The only way to avert future state budget crisis is to get a handle on spending. Unless this is done, expect a continual parade of crises and bills like this. I urge Republicans to stand pat. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Co-chairs Barnhart and Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony K. Smith, Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. NFIB represents about 7,000 small businesses here in Oregon, many being the smallest of small businesses. And although 90% of our members have fewer than 25 employees and 70% have fewer than 10, the small businesses we represent account for over 60,000 Oregon jobs. I'm here today to express our strong opposition to the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2830 and any alternative plan that would effectively raise taxes on Oregon small businesses. Last year, NFIB members voted overwhelmingly to oppose the concept of a gross receipts tax, not necessarily because they were worried about paying the tax directly, but because of the negative effects it would have on them as consumers of larger businesses and customers, consumers of the same products and services used by nearly every Oregonian, but they also oppose the concept because of the very idea of taxing a business on its gross sales, whether it makes a profit or not, is quite objectionable to entrepreneurs who already bear the financial and legal risks of owning, operating, and growing a small business. When we surveyed our members on ballot measure 97, 95% of our respondents opposed it. And even though our members tend to be reliably skeptical of revenue-raising proposals, I thought it was going to be a long time before I saw our members speak so clearly with one voice as they did last year. That all changed in recent weeks when we surveyed our members again on the framework that's been discussed in this committee. A staggering 99% of our respondents opposed the idea of adding pass-through entities to the list of businesses that would be subject to the gross receipts tax. And that was before we told them that the repeal of the pass-through entity rates were also part of the proposal. Members of Senate Finance and Revenue may recall my prior testimony on several bills related to this topic and the survey we conducted back in February to find out how NFIB members have used the pass-through entity tax rates in previous tax years and how they plan to use them moving forward. We did this survey back in February just of this year before they were filing their 26 returns, and we found some interesting results. I'll just be very quick with that, but 28% of the respondents reported using the small business pass-through entity tax rates in tax year 2015. Now, that was the first year that this was available to taxpayers. But the big takeaway that we found from the survey was that 42% of survey respondents were planning to use the rate for tax year 2016, a significant increase over the prior year. What that demonstrated to us was that most small businesses were largely unaware of the change in tax policy starting in 2015. But upon learning more about the tax structure, which types of businesses qualify and what types of income qualify, small business owners were much more likely to integrate the use of the pass-through entity tax rates into their business plans. Now, I've heard statements recently from those asserting that the commercial activities tax proposal's gross revenue threshold of $3 million effectively exempts small businesses from being taxed under the plan. But this line of thinking doesn't pencil out so long as the repeal of the PTE tax rates are part of the proposal. And to make matters worse for small business, the tax savings we see from the PTE rates would be redirected to the larger pass-through entities in the form of the CAT credit that I see under the dash twos has been changed from 43% to 50% and then 25%. Now, that when we were talking about the 43% CAT credit, it seemed to me that 43% was kind of an arbitrary number that was created to offset the tax expenditure of the PTE repeal. I don't know where the 50% and the 25% figures come from, but if they're not based on a tax purpose or a tax reason or an economic reason, then I would be skeptical of that. And the credit itself acknowledges the double taxation problem for these higher volume businesses. They'll be taxed first on their gross sales, then again on the profits that pass through to them as individuals, as personal income. Small businesses paying 7% in net business income today would be paying 8.75% under this proposal, and then an additional $250 minimum tax for businesses with sales over $150,000 a year. And this is exactly the case for one of our members. Her name is Rachel. She's a business owner in Washington County. She recently reached out to our office when she heard about this proposal and had a bunch of questions. And so I asked her a bunch of questions to try to help her figure out how this was going to affect her. And what we found out was that Rachel and her business partner, they own an S Corp, and while their gross sales are still under $3 million per year, their profit margin is less than 2%. The difference between paying 7% on that profit and 8.75 or 9% might seem small, but when those margins are slim, every dollar counts. Right now, Rachel's able to employ 3 full-time workers, but she'd like to hire 2 more employees as her business continues to grow. Now, fortunately, Rachel and her business partner own a second business with lower overhead and better margins, and this is the business enterprise that pays their bills, but it doesn't have any employees. She worries that a change in tax policy is going to hurt the profitability of the business that employs those 3 to 5 workers, and at some point it won't be economically feasible to keep the doors open. Now, Rachel and her partner might be okay since they have that other business to put 100% of their time and effort into, but the employees that they currently employ don't have a fallback plan. This is just one example of how seemingly small numbers and slight changes in percentages really matter to small businesses and their employees. NFIB members believe that government policies shouldn't be the reason that an otherwise viable business venture fails. It's hard enough to own, operate, and grow a small business, and when the rules change significantly every couple of years, the task becomes even harder. We urge you to oppose House Bill 2830 and any amendments that will raise taxes on Oregon's small business. Thank you for the opportunity today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. For the Oregon Farm Bureau, what percentage of your membership have sales over $3 million in the state of Oregon?
Co-chairs Hass and Barnhart, Representative Hernandez, we are actually trying to figure that out at this point. I believe there were some early simulations from Legislative Revenue Office at the $1 million threshold that had about 2,100 farms directly impacted. We are still working on with Department of Revenue, or trying to get in contact to fully understand which farms would be directly impacted by that. But also a point of clarification, not all of our farms are essentially, they don't all follow the NAICS code. So they're not all registered under the Ag NAICS code. There would be retail operations and wholesale processing, depending on the different operations. So I don't know what the scope of that survey looked at as well. So
follow up. It would be good to know from the 3 million threshold, not the 1 million, because that's the bill, which companies or businesses are actually impacted through that rate compared to your overall membership, and just to be able to see who's actually impacted and who's not. And then a question for NFIB, similar question. Out of, you said 7,000 members, how many of those businesses do 3 million in sales in the state of Oregon? Do you know that?
And if not, you could provide that information to us later in writing.
Sure. Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, Representative Fernandez, we don't track that data within our membership. We don't ask them how much money they make, but we can infer from LRO data and just from our what we know about our members. In the first year that the small business tax rates were in effect, which was tax year 2015, about 13,000 filers filed using the small business tax rates. Now, we know from our survey that 28% of our 7,000 members took advantage of the lower tax rates that first year. So, you know, it's somewhere in the neighborhood, you know, of several hundred members of ours were using those small business tax rates. Now, the $3 million threshold, I can't answer that question. I think it's very few for us. I think our members tend to be tend to have modest incomes, and that's why we're very, very concerned about the fact that the repeal of the PTE tax rates are included in this package, because right now they are mostly probably paying at 7%, and under this plan, that's going to increase to 8.75%.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Haas, please.
Thank you, Jenny. I'm very sympathetic to agricultural prices. They're commodities, mm-hmm. and you know, sometimes the dairy farmers can't do anything about condition in Chile or Peru that might affect mm-hmm. farm prices up here. So would, and I know you're engaged with this and it's very helpful, would some of this concern or heartburn, as you put it, go away if we just exempted agriculture?
Co-chair Haas, members of the committee, we thought we might get this question today. I think for the reasons that I stated in my response to Representative Hernandez, we would still have some issues because our sector isn't just limited just to the agriculture NAICS code. Our operations tend to be very diverse, and so on the dairy side, you've got the processing. For some of our farms, you have the farm retail, farm stands. So I think our industry is a lot more complicated than even I realized when we first engaged in this discussion. It's a discussion we'd be happy to bring back to our membership, but we appreciate the consideration, but our understanding, kind of looking at the landscape right now, is that it wouldn't be a perfect fit for all family circumstances within our membership. And that they're still going to be looking at the pass-through entity rates and at the pyramiding. And there's, I think that the pyramiding is probably what they're going to be focused on more. But I'm happy to kind of dive in and get back to you. Thanks.
Well, there's no pyramiding if the tax is zero. So it's something to consider. The crop prices, I can understand exempting those. Now, when you talk about retail and processing, now we're into other categories that aren't as affected by the prices of chili and asparagus in Peru or those other things. So, thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Smith, please.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. And I don't mean to be confrontational, but I'm not sure who NFIB is completely representing.
I'm thinking about my small businesses in Heppner on Main Street, and my small businesses on Main Street in Milton Freewater. And I'm not sure they don't benefit from this. I've read more tax returns. Well, there's some CPAs in here, so I won't say anyone. My head could spin. And this is pretty darn good for a lot of small businesses, especially in small, little, rural, remote communities. And so what I'm trying to get my arms around is where NFIB's position is coming from. Right. Maybe it's just a difference in definition of small business. I don't know who on Main Street in Heppner, other than Les Schwab, is generating more than $3 million in sales.
Co-chairs, Representative Smith, again, I don't think a lot of our members, which 70% of our members have fewer than 10 employees. We're the smallest of the small. I don't think a lot of our members are above that $3 million threshold, and that's exactly why what I'm really concerned about as a part of this proposal is the repeal of the PTE tax rates. Now, mm-hmm. These are the special tax rates that were part of the grand bargains in the special session of 2013, and it rolled back that individual pass-through entity tax rate from the 9 or 9.9% individual income tax rates to a tax rate that starts at 7%. And again, from our survey, we found out that in the first year that it was available, you know, only about a quarter of our membership took advantage of it. But as they became more aware of the opportunity to pay at the lower rate.
Thank you. You've told us that.
Sure.
This is the third time.
Well, I would appreciate you visiting with me.
Sure.
Offline, because
absolutely.
I'm still not getting it.
Yeah, and if you want to amplify your answers to any of the questions that have been asked, please feel free to do that in writing and get it to the committee administrator, and we'll be happy to review it. Appreciate that very much. Thank you, the three of you, for testifying. I want our audience to be aware that the House, most of the House members have caucus at 10 o'clock, so we're going to adjourn before then. I think I have time for one more panel. We will be meeting again tonight at 5 o'clock, so those who don't get a chance to testify now may come back then or submit testimony in writing, and we'd appreciate that. And I do have that right, don't I, that we can adjourn and then open a new meeting at 5 o'clock. We do. Okay. Mitzi Bauer, Stephanie Rose, Hannah Vanderling, please. And colleagues, I think this will be our last panel, and we will adjourn before 10 o'clock, so we'll hope they can be brief.
Great, thank you. My name is Mitzi Bauer. I'm on the North Clackamas School Board and been a parent volunteer for years. I want to ask you to strongly support this measure. This bill will provide the stability people have talked about. I'll skip over some of it that's already been talked about. It's a great investment in the workforce. I know from what I've seen that the cost containments are not going to be enough for us to truly move forward. In North Clackamas, we are desperately trying to plan a school budget for the next 2 years. The 8.2 would be cuts to our district, $2 million from the current service level, another $7 million from our fund balance. We have been as responsible as we can trying to prepare for what we saw as some cuts coming. We're fortunate that our staff is willing to take freeze in salaries and days off. Class sizes are big. We have to make hard decisions in North Clackamas, but there's never enough for this broken system. So when the economy is in recession, we're making even drastic cuts. And with a recession possibly coming, I just can't even imagine. I'll read a few examples of a portion from a letter from a parent that her son is graduating from our district this year. In kindergarten last week, a school was canceled due to funding cuts. First grade elementary science was eliminated due to funding cuts. Second grade, their only field trip was a public bus ride to the public library because the school had no library. Sixth grade, my children's elementary school building was closed due to funding cuts, and we've done that more than once over the 30 years I've been there. Seventh grade, due to inadequate administration, student pranksters pulled the fire alarm dozens of times throughout the school year, resulting in constant learning disruptions. Eighth grade, science, social studies instruction time was cut in half to allow more time for math and language arts because students were struggling to meet the rigorous Common Core. ninth grade, 25% of our district teachers, classified staff, administrators were laid off due to funding gap, and we have not recovered from that yet. Secondary class sizes rose to 46 in academic subjects, 60 in PE, 100 in band and choir. Our favorite orchestra teacher taught in 9 schools that year. My husband still was a PE teacher in the district. One time he had 832 children in one class, 1 year. He did not know their names. He said maybe by third and fourth grade. 10th grade, another 10 days were cut.
If you could wrap up so the other two have a couple minutes.
Thank you so much. This plan is equitable. It's directed to education, includes income tax adjustment. It's very thoughtful. A lot of reasoning has gone into it. There's plenty of time for corporations to review. I had heard of it some time ago. So thank you so much. We need your leadership for kids and schools, and we need a true investment. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Co-chairs Haas and Barnhart, as well as members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. My name is Stephanie Rose, and I live in the unincorporated area of Clackamas County. I have 3 children who attend the North Clackamas School District. I could go on about all of the school cuts that we have made, but I wanted to point out that roughly 88% of Oregon's youth are in our public schools. We have been funding public schools at subpar or detrimental levels for decades now. School has changed so much since I went to Oregon Public Schools. We, depending on how you work the numbers, we come in around 21st in per student education funding. We could say that we come in last, maybe fourth, maybe fifth in corporate tax rate. But the thing is that I don't want to be in a state that's celebrating not coming in last. I want us to be celebrating being drivers, movers, shakers, giving our kids and our future just the ability to build a better, stronger Oregon and be a part of that. We are leaving an entire generation of Oregonians at a disadvantaged future right now. Oregon families, through income tax as well as other taxes, fund almost 95% of our general fund. It is time that corporations step up, pay their fair share, and move or help move Oregon into the future and take some of the weight off of these families. I am in support of 2830. I appreciate that your amendments that you're looking at are trying to keep the levels stable as we go into the future. And I ask you to please support some revenue impact that can make a tremendous impact and move Oregon into the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Co-chairs Barnhart and Haas, I'm happy to come back this evening so that people can get to their caucus if that's appropriate.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. And if you'll sign up again tonight. I got a question by text a moment ago. If you're planning to come back tonight to testify, we'll try to get you from the list from this morning, but be safer if you just signed up again. Thank you. Appreciate it very much, and we will reconvene in another meeting at 5 o'clock, and hopefully we'll see some of you here then. Committee is adjourned.